his precocity in terms of the brand building is as extraordinary as his precocity in terms of footballing talent, which makes him really a very, very special, very unique type of modern footballer.
Hello and welcome to Outlines, a podcast about sport, stories and the media. My name's Owen Connolly. Hope you're well. It is great to have you listening. The careers of top athletes can tell us a lot about the era and the environment they're playing in. And that's especially true of someone like Kylian Mbappe, who's made an extraordinary impact on global football across the last decade. A World Cup winner with France, the scorer of 5 goals across 2 World Cup finals, as in the final game, not the tournament, he's made a scorching impression on the pitch since his mid-teens. His club career perhaps has been more complicated, despite putting up big numbers for Monaco, PSG and Real Madrid. But what's especially intriguing is the way his career has been managed, with his family and a tight-knit team of advisors steering him carefully through an age of outsized commerce, political influence and social media frenzy. That approach is the subject of a new book, The Mbappe Project, and our guest this time is the author of that book, the great Philippe Auclair, a French football writer, broadcaster and podcaster who's chiefly been based in the UK since the 1990s. He's worked extensively for The Guardian and France Football, as well as the likes of Eurosport, TalkSport and the BBC. And more recently, he's been turning out investigative journalism for Yossimar and organisations like Play the Game. Some will know him too as a prolific musician and singer-songwriter. That, sadly, is a conversation for another day. But he did talk about the unique path taken by Kylian Mbappe and why he chose this particular angle on his story. We go through the details of the Mbappe Project, his background, his early reputation, and how his team formed around him. We explore where Mbappe diverges from the expected archetypes of the elite footballer and how that shaped his decisions. Philippe talks about how the book differs structurally, technically and creatively from his earlier biographies of Eric Cantona and Thierry Henry, and what that might tell us about footballers and the media in 2026. And he discusses where Mbappe sits for the French public in the pantheon of great football icons, how the vagaries of his club journey factor into that, and why the next couple of years, beginning of course with this summer's World Cup, are set to be so definitive. Really fun and absorbing chat. That's all to come. Before then, let's talk about this project and your role in building it. If you're enjoying the podcast, please do subscribe, rate and review on your platform of choice. Like and share what you see on social media. Details of those accounts are in the show notes. Any way you can spread the word is much appreciated. And of course, if you want to get involved, get in touch. Right, let's crack on. You're in for a treat this time. Here is Philippe Auclair. So keep him busy. So is that a function of there being a World Cup coming up? Is that a function of the end of a football season? Or are you working on other things that you maybe...
I'm working on everything. The World Cup is actually quite low on my priorities at the moment. First of all, it's still 5 weeks away. Just under 5 weeks away now. But I'm very busy with Yossimar. I'm very busy with the music as well. So I've got my plate is absolutely full. Not that I necessarily want to share what is my plate. I quite enjoy having loads in my plate, but it is a full plate at the moment. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, a couple of things we'll get to maybe before we wrap up there. But we're going to talk in the main about the Mbappe project. Is this your third kind of quasi-biography of a French footballer?
Yes, quasi-biography, because I did the first one was a... The first two were actual proper biographies, so to speak. The first one about Eric Cantona and the second one about Thierry Henry. But this one is a little bit different. It's not quite the last of the third side of a trilogy. It's not that. because he's a very different player to both Eric and Thierry. They're all very different books anyway, in as much they're very different characters, they're very different footballers, and they're very different ages of football. It's three ages of football in three footballers, which might be the reason why writing a biography of Kylian was not something I had in mind, and I wanted to do something quite different about him that would have obviously a lot of biographical detail in it, and you could read it like that. I think you'll have a pretty good idea of his career so far when you read the book. But it is not a biography of Kylian Mbappé as it was genuinely a biography of Eric Cantona or a biography of Thierry Henry.
Yeah, it's kind of, I suppose the process of it would be, it's about the construction of Kylian Mbappé. So there's some stuff about him and his character and his, you know, his upbringing, but a lot more of it is about how quickly the people around him get to grips with what it means to manage a football career in the 21st century.
And how you build this as a completely unique project, unique because of the nature of the player, because whatever your opinion might be of Kylian Mbappé, and there are loads of opinions about when it comes to Kylian Mbappé, the talent is unique, but also the way he's got to where he's got is unique. His family circumstances, the way the brand has been built, the way the brand is being maintained, controlled, exploited, whichever way you want to look at it, is also completely unique. And I don't think it's something that's happened before. I'm sure of that. It's never happened before in that way. And I'm not absolutely sure it could happen again the same way because of the, the concatenation of circumstances and the context in which Kylian became Mbappé is very different from what's happened to other football superstars before, even including Cristiano Ronaldo or Lionel Messi or Neymar, people like that. And what can happen in the future to people like Lamine Yamal or Désiré Doué. So it's completely a one-off, and it's the one-offness of the project, which I think is really interesting. Really, really interesting. Interesting enough for me to devote a lot of time researching it and writing about it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about how it's come together, because, you know, in the main, there's not a lot of conversation with the principals. There's interviews with Mbappé and interviews with people close to him, interviews from earlier sources and things like that. It's kind of an investigative or research exercise as much as anything else.
Absolutely. And which is very much in keeping with the type of journalism I do these days, which is almost exclusively investigative journalism, even if I still cover football normally, you know, for the Guardian, for the Weekly, Football Weekly, or for Eurosport. But most of my work, really, I think three quarters of my football work is investigative in nature, and mostly for Yozima and for Play the Game, and sometimes some other people. But so it fits very much. It's in between the two. So there's an element which is purely about football, another element which is an investigative element, and forensic, if you prefer that. Getting interviews with Mbappé anyway is almost impossible. Actually, it is impossible. Talking to the people around him is also impossible. I tried it at the beginning because at the beginning I was approached. It was not my idea. It was at the back of my mind, but it was proposed to me. I said, well, why don't you do a book about Mbappé? I said, let me think about it. And when I came back to the people who had suggested it, I said, I'm very happy to do it as long as it's not a biography. Mm. But also I tried to get in touch with the Mbappé camp, so to speak. And they were very polite and courteous with me, but they made it very clear that they had no intention of collaborating. They had no intention of being part of the project. I think maybe some people within the camp would have been open to it, but I think the man himself had other things to do. And also, you cannot go, when you write a biography of a current football figure, You have to go about your job completely differently in 2026 that you would have done it in 2016. It's a different world altogether, and which is one of the reasons why I haven't read any biographies of current footballers, which I've been convinced by, because everything is so controlled, so monitored, that you have very little. I mean, what I did with Eric and even with Thierry would be totally unthinkable today. Mm-hmm. In terms of access, in terms of talking to the people who matter to these figures, and in terms of talking to the figures themselves. Or what I did, for example, with Juan Mata, because so that's not a biography, it was Juan's own book, but I helped him write it. But that's Juan. Juan is very different type of character, shall we say. There is no Mata project, there is just Juan Mata.
Just on that point of it not being a biography, is that because of that technical challenge that you talk about with the level of kind of authorial control you have mm-hmm. now as a biographer? Or is that also just because, like, Kylian Mbappe is halfway through his career? It doesn't feel like it because he's been around so long. But, it's not.
He's only 27.
By any means. Yeah,
he's only 27. And in a way, we wanted to get this done before the World Cup for many reasons. Because in a way, this World Cup is also another appointment with destiny for him. And it doesn't really make sense to write the biography of somebody who is 27. For Eric, I had no problem at all because he had retired for a long time when I started working on the book. And for Thierry was really coming to the end of his career. And in fact, the book really finished with his goal against Leeds for Arsenal, which was basically that's the conclusion of the story.
There's a dramatic arc there that's kind of
It's beautiful. But for Kylian, you can't do that because his greatest moments and his most awful moments are perhaps ahead of him. He still has many things to fight for and to win. Another World Cup title, a Champions League title, a La Liga title as well. And especially in this case, a Ballon d'Or, and he ain't got any of those. So he'll keep going, I think, as long as, I mean, he has got aims, objectives that he hasn't fulfilled yet. So the project is not has not come to an end. The career of the player is still, I think, it's about 2/3 through his career. He's not halfway through. He started very young. Let's not forget that. And even if he comes, he might carry on until he's 34, 35. I'm not convinced of that, by the way. But he might carry on for a while. But it would be absurd to decide to put a final, a full stop. So that's the story, or that's the story so far. I mean, there are a couple of books which are coming out, which are of this ilk, but they're very much, with all respect to the people who worked on them, but they are basically cashing in. On this progression so far, with very much the idea that he might become a world champion for the second time, so let's get there first. But it wouldn't make any sense, and the lack of direct sources. What I mean, direct, I had, of course, I talked to an awful lot of people, but I didn't talk to anybody apart from Kylian's lawyer. But I only had one conversation, which was incredibly interesting, but I only had one conversation with her. I didn't do that. And to be honest, I don't miss it. Mm-hmm. And I think I didn't miss it. And I think that everything is so controlled now that it's like if you're writing a Cristiano Ronaldo biography, and there are quite a few around, most of them are just like picture books. Some of them are just... there is no proper investigative look at Cristiano's career, which is a pity because it's really well worth digging into for so many reasons. I don't want to go into details here. I don't want to get you into trouble either. the same way that there are no proper biographies of Messi because some people have written about Ronaldo, some people have written about Messi, some better than others. There are some very decent things being published there, out there, but they remain incredibly superficial. Because you can't deal with the real questions. It's as simple as that. Today, if you write about a superstar of that ilk, with their authorization, you become a member of their PR team. This is the way football in 2026 works. That was not the case for Eric. That was not the case for Thierry. And what was not the case for Juan. But this is different. I mean, Kylian is different. If you start to deal with that, the attention, the paranoia is such that you will find yourself totally, your hands will be tied behind your back, and you won't be able to talk about the things which really matter, in my view. Certainly not when you approach Kylian as a project rather than a footballer.
For sure. Let's talk about that. I think that there's probably two parts of this conversation. The first is about the project, and and then maybe the second is a little bit about the place he occupies in kind of the French football imagination now. And I think there's an interplay between the two, but
Very much so.
You know, how early on did you as a journalist become aware of Mbappe? I mean, the book begins with you going and talking to the staff at Middlesbrough about
who's that guy
about that. Yeah, but like by that stage you think they're already, and this is 10 years ago now, but they're already kind of ahead of the curve. But it's always interesting with these very, very young breakout stars, at what point people become aware of them.
I became aware of him when he went to Monaco myself.
Yeah.
Because there was quite a lot of coverage. I mean, he'd made a name for himself with youth teams in Bondy, at Clairefontaine as well. Everybody knew he was a bit special. I mean, very special. And then I became aware of the fact that an awful lot of clubs were fighting for his signature. I didn't know at the time that he had a trial at Chelsea. I didn't know he had gone to Real Madrid for a full week at the invitation of Zinedine Zidane. And he was just a teenager at the time, 12, 13. And I became aware of him just after that, when he basically left Clairefontaine to join AS Monaco in between, in that period. And which is why, one of the first chapters in the book is about this conversation I had in Middlesbrough with the scouts there, because he had just, he was becoming a name in France and in Europe, but within the cognoscenti knew all about him already. But my question was, how early did they know about him? And this is why this visit to Middlesbrough, strangely enough, talking to one of Monchi's assistants, was important, because it showed that this guy had already been a target for recruiters and scouts for 5-6 years when he signed as a 15-year-old for Monaco, which is insane. And I know it's quite, these days, it's usual. Under 11s even are being followed and so forth. Yeah, I know. But for Mbappe, the level of interest was absolutely extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. And from a very, very young age. So that's when I became aware of him. And then Europe became aware of him very quickly indeed after I had this conversation, because he played for Manchester City for Monaco in the Champions League. And then suddenly, within two games, everybody knew who Kylian Mbappe was, or everybody knew his name. Not necessarily everybody knew who he was, but he had just exploded on the scene, and there was no turning back after that. So, but I think at the time, I certainly wasn't thinking I would ever write a book about it. It's more that I was thinking, well, is he symptomatic of the way that people go about identifying talent and scouting these days? And I was wondering, how early had he been identified by the big actors? And the answer is almost immediately, that it was never about... It was never going to be about a small club. It was not going to be a Kvaratskhelia, for example. It was not going to be somebody who was going to be found by chance. Anyway, once you've gone to Clairefontaine, you know already that people are going to follow you. But his precocity in terms of the brand building is as extraordinary as his precocity in terms of footballing talent, which makes him really a very, very special, or very unique type of modern footballer.
Yeah, because this is the thing. If clubs around Europe are aware of him and there's interest in him, and you know he's doing things like turning down a place at Real Madrid's academy, his family are aware of that even earlier. You know, they know what kind of conversations are happening around him, and what the interest is going to be. And
yeah, I mean, he signed his first sponsorship deal when he was 8 years old with Nike. So, you know, that tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah, there's something about his story. You know, there's two kinds of stories that we have with athletes like this that kind of the media is used to and comfortable with shaping. And when I say comfortable, I mean as in the narrative machinery is there to tell that story, right?
Yeah.
One is the sort of diamond in the rough player who comes from, you know, poverty or some form of something that instills a certain hunger in them and drive and makes them stand out from other people, and that's allied to talent, and off they go. Or it becomes a part of their story in the way maybe it does with a Maradona, that's always, you know, part of their character. And the other, and maybe less in football, but certainly in sports like tennis, the hot housing and the, you know, I put a racket in your hand or a ball at your feet or a bat in your hand at three. And he's neither of those things.
No, he's not. He's not. He doesn't come from a rough background at all. He comes from a lower middle class family with two people who had decent jobs, got decent pay, lived in a nice flat. He had plenty of presents when he was young. He, you know, he was a bit spoilt as a child, as a matter of fact. And but he certainly didn't. Encounter any hardship. You know, he's not the Luis Suarez or even a Jamie Vardy. He's not one of those players, or a Kvaratskhelia, or a Sadio Mane, who left his village in Senegal and found himself in Metz in France at the age of 14 or 15, not knowing anybody and surviving. Or like Eduardo coming from Brazil to Croatia. You know, we've all got plenty of those stories. He's not like that at all. In a way, he's an establishment kid. You know, he's not a Nepo baby, but an establishment kid, because from very early age, first of all, his parents are both sports people. His mother was a very, very fine handball player in a country where handball is taken very, very seriously indeed. She was a pro. And his dad was not a pro, but he was a coach and of US Bondi, which had already got a reputation for, you know, turning out talents. And so he was in that environment. There was the older adopted brother, Gires Kembo. So he was in an environment in which, yes, hardship, despite what people have said about his upbringing in the Parisian banlieue, it was very smooth. It's like, you know, US Bondi, 8-year-old, 9-year-old, go to Clairefontaine, no problem, go to Clairefontaine, go to Monaco, go to PSG, go to Real Madrid. Easy. But not everything was planned. You know, the start point, we know what it is, and the end result, we know what they wanted. I want to play for Real Madrid. I want to play for France, and I want to be the captain of France. So, and he's there, almost. He's there, but he's not quite there.
Yeah.
So there is the narrative is not is, and he was not hothoused, and I tell a few stories in the book about other hothoused players and players who were bullied and players who suffered a lot, were really traumatized in their childhood by parents, pushy parents. And also the children who today, the children whose parents think that the Mbappé project is replicable, which it is not. So, and they are hothoused. He was not. There were elements of it, of hot housing, but which had nothing to do with daddy on the touchline screaming at his son, abusing the coaches, or bullying the son, or things like that. No, he was hot housed in a way which is different, which is that he received a proper education. He was given private tuition. His parents made sure that he had interests outside of football. They made sure that he could master foreign languages. They made sure that his progress at school, which was a bit complicated because of his personality, because of his superb intelligence. He's a gifted child. At school, he was a gifted child, which means that things were sometimes very difficult for him, like they are for all gifted children. But they made absolutely sure that he would be in the right environment, and that he would be protected, and that he would be followed, and that he would be advised, and so forth. But they tried to channel him. They didn't try to push him. There's a very big difference between the two.
Yeah.
So they defined the channel. This is where you're going, but we're not pushing you. We're helping you, but we're not pushing you. And at times, you know, they did things a bit similar to what hot housing parents do in terms of a relationship with some youth coaches, for example. But it's nothing like, you know, what you can read about or about other players who are literally shoehorned and sometimes against their will in a career that maybe they want to have this career, maybe not. They're just good at it. And in his case, they didn't have to push him very hard because he wanted to go there. And which is also something very unique is that he has authored his own life as a footballer from a far younger age than other footballers do. He's been in control or partly in control from a very, very early age when he was a teenager. He was already pulling his own strings, so to speak. He was not a puppet, and he's not.
Yeah. What did that look like practically at that point? What's the environment? I mean, you talk about the parental stuff, getting, you know, private tuition and getting him into a good school and kind of rounding, making sure he has a kind of rounded existence as a you know, a prodigy in his early teens. But like, what does it look like from a practical point of view? You've talked about how he's precocious in terms of his commercial activities. You know, what's the team that his family build around him?
The team at the beginning is very, very small. I mean, the team is basically his dad, Wilfried, and his mother, Faiza, with a few friends of the family and a few parents as well, from the extended family, particularly on Wilfried's side, and also through the Cameroonian, the group of Cameroonians whom Wilfried knew. You're talking about the Mbomas, for example. People will remember Patrick Mboma, and they were part of it. Mm-hmm. And they had also connections within the coaching world. But it was very, very small. And the people who actually provided advice to Killian is very much his close family. Up until the age of 15, when things start becoming very serious, because you've got to make some important choices as to the club where you're going to try and go through it to the first team. This is where Delphine Verheyden arrives, the lawyer, and who becomes the main advisor, certainly in terms, not for on the sporting side, but everything that is commercial, everything that is image related, everything that is business, basically. Delphine, who is an absolutely, utterly brilliant lawyer, everybody will tell you that, becomes the person who is in charge of making sure everything happens as it should. She takes care of the sponsorship deals. She takes care of the contracts and so on and so forth. But he doesn't have an agent as such. You know, he doesn't have an agent. His mother today acts as an agent, but he never had a proper football agent like Cristiano Ronaldo might have Jorge Mendes. Yeah. Or like, that's not the case. Or Zlatan and Paul Pogba at Mino Raiola. You know, it never had that. And in fact, they made sure that these people were kept out of the circle, which is a very important part, obviously, of the project. We want to keep control. That means that we cannot relinquish any of this control to a third party. And Delphine is not an agent. She's a lawyer. She doesn't earn commission on what he does, his sponsorship contracts, his bonuses, and so forth. She gets paid by the hour, a lot of money, I would imagine, she and her team. But they're there to advise. They're there to, again, to define the channels and also to prevent things from happening. It's like, don't sign with this sponsor. Not good for you. Not good for you.
Yeah.
Or these terms like, no, they're not acceptable. But purely from an outside point of view, you see. So it's, again, how many other players are doing that? And to my knowledge, absolutely none. It's a completely unique cell of people. It's very, very, very small. A few more people have been added from the sidelines. People like Patricia Goldman, who looks after his public image. Lawyers who would be brought in for other judicial problems or legal problems, but also judicial problems like what happened with the, you know, accusations that were, you know, that were made against him in Stockholm. But it's a very, very small team. And it's not a team of football people, which is, you know, Wilfried, who has actually taken now, is in the background. He's actually done what he had to do. He's still the dad, and he still, I'm sure, offers words of wisdom and so forth, but he no longer is the one who will advise his son as to what he should do next.
Yeah.
The others, most of whom are women, which is something which is also very unusual, are people who are there to maximize the earnings, to maximize the brand, to minimize the risks, and so on and so forth. He's big enough, he's smart enough, he's independent enough to take care of his own affairs, even if he has got a group of people around him, a very, very close group, which again is one of the reasons why would you do a biography of somebody who is so protected by people who won't talk to you? That wouldn't make sense, right?
Yeah. Let's look at that team in action then as he starts to progress through his career. So he's at Monaco for a season or a season and a half. I can't remember. It all ends in...
For a bit longer than that, but he...
But I mean, as a first-team player, so the period you talk about when scores against Manchester City, and then it's over in a bit of a hurry.
It's about a year and a half in total from the moment that he really breaks into the team. They become French champions. They go to the semi-finals of the Champions League, and then Paris Saint-Germain moves in, Paris Saint-Germain, who had been obviously following him for a very long time, move in, and then he moves from Monaco to PSG for seven seasons. It's quite brief, but in a way, the time that he spent between arriving at the club and being in the first team is absolutely crucial, because that's the only hint of jeopardy that he's had in his career, because he found it quite difficult, as I'm sure any 14 or 15-year-old would find difficult, to be uprooted as he was, and to be suddenly sent to that, you know, that club. His dad took a flat in Monaco, but he was still very much left to his own devices. And also, he had a fairly conflictual relationship with some of the youth coaches there, one in particular, Bruno Irle. And which at one point threatened to derail his career at Monaco and created a lot of tensions between the family and the club, which was finally resolved when Leonardo Jardim decided, oh, I can't do without this boy, and put him in the first team. Then that was fine. But the first year and a half, so it's 1 year and a half of struggling. He's struggling. He's playing for the reserves. Mm-hmm. He's playing for the U19s. He's playing, you know, it's not happening for him. And then he integrates the team. And it's another year and a half, but this is the year and a half where he explodes on the scene.
Lift off.
Everybody gets to know him, and he becomes the hottest property in French and European football.
Yeah. And then there's three decisions with, you know, we're speed running this a bit, which is appropriate given the subject, but there's three decisions really in his career that feel like they could go another way, but possibly, you know, when you know about how careful he's been managed, that maybe they were always going to go this way. But there's the move to PSG in the first place. Mm-hmm. I remember Arsenal were in for him, which felt slightly quixotic at the time, given the way things had gone for Arsenal in the previous couple of years. But maybe that would have been a move 10 years earlier that he'd have made, or 15 years earlier. And then he chooses to stay at PSG.
Yes.
When he looks almost certain to go to Real Madrid. And then eventually he does go to Real Madrid. So what are the thoughts? What's the planning that goes into that career progression as far as his team are concerned?
I think the first one is the easiest to perhaps explain. Mm-hmm. It feels like a natural step up. He's been in a very good club, Monaco, which is doing well at the time, which had this fabulous team with Bernardo Silva, Radamel Falcao, and all the others. Fabinho was there too. Mendy was there. I mean, it was a magnificent team.
Yeah.
And so he makes it makes complete sense to be there, and then afterwards to go up one level. But he's still very young. and he wants to take his time. And they get a fantastic offer from PSG, both the club and the family and the player, where he multiplies his salary by, I can't remember, a factor of what, maybe 12, something like that, something ridiculous. Also, it's the guarantee, if he goes to PSG, he will play. If he goes to Real Madrid already, not absolutely certain that he will command a place in the starting 11. If he goes to PSG, there's a very good chance that he's going to be a starter. And not only that he's going to be a starter, but he's going to become one of the main guys together with Neymar. And so it makes a lot of sense. And also it's the guarantee of winning titles, which is, you know, something to think about. It's staying in France for a bit longer, close to his family, close to his friends, which also makes a great deal of sense. He also joins a club which is extremely ambitious when it comes to European football. So that's fine. So all these decisions make a lot of sense. The decision to stay at Paris Saint-Germain, though, is the one for me which is the most quixotic almost. Mm-hmm. Because everybody, and I mean everybody, thought he was going to join Real Madrid. And I think he himself, at one point, was convinced he would join them. And he had been very critical of PSG's, you know, in a very Mbappe way. So a little bit underhand, dare I say. Mm-hmm. But he had made it very clear that he was not too happy about the way the club was going, the recruitment, or rather the lack of recruitment of players who could genuinely challenge for big honours, and so on. So it came as a big surprise when he decided, I mean, there was one week in which they had all these meetings with Nasser Al-Khelaifi, the PSG chairman, and the family, and they decided to stay. One of the reasons why they decided to stay also was the amount of money that PSG was willing to pay, which was insane. Which was totally insane. And even they, actually, Faiz Alamari, his mother, when she was asked about it, she really said that they plucked a figure out of the air, which was, they thought, so absurd that PSG would never countenance it. And to their surprise, they said, yeah, that's fine. That's fine. We'll pay that. And they did. And they made good business.
Yeah, it's also the moment that one, where his role at PSG feels that it's the point at which it most encapsulates, like, his significance to that project at the time, his significance to France. I think there's a moment where does the president get involved in the conversation?
Yeah,
it gets very Pelé at one point.
Yeah, Macron.
And then also
involved
the ties
directly
between, and then that reminds you of the ties between, economically, between Qatar and France, that kind of,
of course, which has got something
PSG
to do with it
in the first place. But then, of course, football ends up taking its course, and by the end of the year, he's gone, and PSG have gone in a completely different direction since.
Yeah,
the other thing about his club career, and, you know, there's a parallel, or he's got parallel careers here.
Yeah,
with France, he's exceeded any realistic expectation or reasonable expectation for a footballer. It's real proper comic book stuff. You know, he's a teenager, gets two goals in a World Cup final, wins, then he gets a hat trick in a World Cup final and gets, you know, within, you know, the width of Emi Martinez's stud of winning again. But in club football, it's been a more frustrated and kind of compromised, and it's felt more like life, and it still is. And, you know, we're talking at the moment as Real Madrid players are narrowly avoiding getting dragged off by the police for knocking seven lumps out of each other in training.
Yep.
And that part of his career is still the bit that maybe where his ambitions need to be realized. What are the effects of that on him as a figure in football, particularly in France, that he is, you know, he has this complicated club career. Maybe he hasn't underachieved, but the teams have achieved things when he's not been there, basically. With France, he's been such a, you know, particularly in World Cups with France, his career has been so spectacular.
Yeah, his career has been spectacular with France. And in fact, I think the peak of popularity for him is after the 2022 World Cup. In 2018, everybody's totally bowled over by his performances at the World Cup. And then, you know, not quite so when Euro 2021 happens. The Euros have been, Euros are not good for Kylian for some reason. He's always arrived at Euros. He was under par physically or mentally, had loads of things to deal with. And he's never been himself properly at the Euro. At the World Cup, yes, it's his stage. And I would say that the stature and the status of the player is very strange. And the more I think about it, the stranger I think it is. Because if you look at the numbers, what he's done is just extraordinary. The numbers are, the stats are phenomenal, you know, with everybody. With Monaco at the end, with PSG, he's the golden boot every year. I mean, and he's not playing alongside, you know, people who are, I mean, he's playing alongside Neymar, Messi, Di Maria, people like that. But he's the key guy. Real Madrid is, he's the Pichichi, he's the guy who finishes, you know, he will score more goals than anybody else. But there's a feeling that he's not pulling his weight, which is weird. Why is it that there is this perception? At Paris Saint-Germain, there were moments where he's, I think the nature of his breakup with PSG, which was a long drawn divorce in which the parties at war were putting all their recriminations out in the open, hasn't helped his image. That's the way I would put it. Because at the beginning, people were quite sympathetic to him. And I'm talking from the PSG camp here, the fans. They were quite sympathetic to him and thought that when he was complaining about this, complaining about that, the complaints were actually founded. And they were not unfounded. But little by little, it became, you know, he's being a bit of a pain in the neck here. He was feted like a hero when he decided to stay on. But people didn't forget that the 7 or 8 months before that had been fraught, and they were having a negative impact on the club. And then as soon as he had signed his new contract, more problems appeared. And so it was a really long drawn divorce. And that really hurt his image and his legacy at PSG. And then he arrives at Real Madrid. And it's a Real Madrid that's even more dysfunctional than previous incarnations, which is saying something. And he's really perceived as one of the reasons why he's dysfunctional. And with hindsight, now people in France are saying, well, that's one of the reasons PSG didn't work. It's because of Mbappé. Look at Kvaratskhelia. Look at Désiré Doué. Look at Barcola. Look at Dembélé. These guys defend as if their lives depended on them. And Mbappé, no, he's never tracked back once in his life, ever, ever. So, and he won't do it. I mean, he's going to have to learn to do it at some point, but so far he hasn't learned to do it. And that's okay in some teams, like with France, which is built in the Didier Deschamps image, where he's being given a kind of license to do what he wants to do because there are other guys doing the dirty work for him. But even with France, his status is a little bit strange. I mean, it's nowhere near where it should be when you think of what he's brought to the table and his performances in particular in two World Cups. Now, I have a little bit of I'm a bit biased here because I'm a Griezmann man. Okay, I'm a Griezmann man through and through rather than a Mbappé man. But I still can see that Mbappé brought a lot, but I think Griezmann brought more. And more consistently. In 2016, obviously, but Kylian wasn't there, but 2016, it was fabulous. 2018 World Cup, best French player is Antoine Griezmann. 2022, take away the goals in the final and the penalties. Who is the best player? Who is the player thanks to whom France gets to the final? It's Antoine Griezmann. And I don't think anybody would disagree with me on that. The final is Mbappé's. No doubt about that. And I think this has played against him. Because there were all these pretty unsavory arguments and conversations about the French captaincy after Hugo Lloris retired after the 2022 World Cup. And to everybody, well, to me certainly, even to most people, Griezmann was the captain in waiting. I mean, it was so obvious. You know, the man who is the anti-Mbappé in terms of tracking back, who is, you know, forged in the Simeone cauldron. And who never had anything easy, who didn't go to the Institut National de Football, who had to fight like mad to get into football and so on, is the anti-Mbappé in some regards. And in terms of personality as well, they're totally different. And so all these things, people have, the perception has changed. And it seems like the more successful he's been, the more critical people have been as well. Now, there's one thing, which is the tall poppy syndrome, but there are other reasons for that.
Yeah.
And which is linked to, you know, they really feel, I think many people feel, if albeit sometimes maybe confusedly, that Mbappé is somebody who practices who is an individual in a collective game, for whom football is an individual sport within the context. And there's one thing, and I think, because I'm going to update the book for the paperback edition in the autumn, but I think one thing that really I'm really fascinated by is the fact that he's yet to be identified with a club.
Yeah.
I know that sounds strange. He spent 7 years at PSG, but he's not identified with PSG the way that Cavani would be, or even Zlatan, or Pauleta, or Marquinhos, obviously, and a lot of the new generation who are, they are, will always be PSG players. Like Thierry Henry is an Arsenal player. Eric Cantona is a Manchester United player. But Kylian Mbappé is not a Monaco player. He's not a PSG player. And he's sure he's not a Real Madrid player at the moment, despite the fact that he's scoring over 40 goals a season for them. He hasn't given himself to a collective project apart from France, which is why you have got this difference in perception. At club level, he's never given himself. France, your country is bigger than anybody who represents it. And which is not necessarily the case for a club. Even if Real Madrid is bigger than Kylian Mbappé, but you could argue, was Kylian Mbappé bigger than PSG when he was at PSG? Well, maybe, actually. It's no longer the case. So it's very ambiguous, isn't it? And it explains why people find it so difficult to be enthused by him as they could be enthused by other players who have got more, identify more, themselves more readily to a particular club. Like Messi's Barca, Ronaldo is Real Madrid. You know, you carry on like that. You know, Totti is Roma. André Pierre Gignac is Tigres. Forever.
What does that do, thinking of him in the context of French players historically at his level? And it's tricky to do this now because, as you say, he's 27. There's a lot of his career ahead. People's emotions around players while they're still playing are very, very different from when they've retired. I remember Thierry Henry had quite a complicated relationship with the French public at times himself.
He did.
But taking all of those things together, the kind of the vagaries of his club career and also the things you were talking about at the start around media and the construction of a public profile in a way that's completely different to, say, a Cantona in particular.
Yeah.
What do you think his example says about where we are in terms of how footballers in particular are viewed and athletes are viewed?
Again, I have to stress the uniqueness of the project, the fact that there are very few people who are comparable to him in this respect, because he's so much in control of the image that he projects. And also because what's been lacking from his career so far is jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
Jeopardy is super important if you want to leave a really big mark in football. In his case, as you say, it's too early, but he's standing in the football that we're talking about is perhaps a football that will mean nothing to people in 10 years' time. That's the other thing that we've got to keep in mind, that the way people eat and drink and consume football is very different today. It will change again, and it will evolve. How it will evolve, I don't know. Strangely enough, at the moment, the evolution seems to be towards the collective, which is to be, you know, saluted, because look at Bayern. You know, that it's a collective force. Look at Barca. Look at PSG. Look at Arsenal. They are collectives in which the collective is more important than the individuals who might be absolutely phenomenal, but the collective is what matters. Mm-hmm. And he represents something different in which the individual is the most important thing, which is a kind of hangover of the Cristiano Messi, you know, it's yours, it's mine, it's yours, it's mine, you know, game of snap for the Ballon d'Or. And that might be a model that belongs to the past. I sincerely hope so. But he's still, if there is a comet, he's in the tail of that comet.
Yeah.
And I think things might change in this respect. So it's possible, which is why if you were to, even though it would be a very generationally influenced poll, if you were to ask French people to name the greatest players in French football history, most important ones, I think most of them now would forget about Raymond Kopa, who was the most important for many generations, well, two or three generations. I still think that Zizou and Michel Platini would mm-hmm. be right at the top, and then it would be a fight for who comes afterwards. I would put Griezmann and Thierry, and I would put Mbappé. But I would put Griezmann ahead of Mbappé, and because I love Titi. but now I accept that, okay, Kylian, yes, just ahead of Thierry, yeah, perhaps. But he's not the best French footballer ever. He's not. And it's not because of the titles, because he's won the titles. You know, he hasn't won as many as Didier Deschamps, but or Zizou, yeah, or Thierry, by the way. But he's already achieved a lot. But if he were, say, to have as great a World Cup in 2026 as he had in 2022, in a different context with a different generation of players, and France went to the end, and he lifted the trophy that time, I think his place would be assured. That would be, he's very aware of it, which is probably why he's really looking after himself at the moment and telling Real, you know what, forget about me. I've got better things to think about than playing in a game that we're going to lose against Barca. I'm preparing for the World Cup. It's the big one. And I think, in a way, that's also the reason why a biography it wouldn't be a great idea at the moment, a proper biography, that is. Is that it's not just too early, but the events of the next couple of seasons might totally change the way that he's perceived.
Yeah.
And also the way that he's going to evolve himself, because he's in a situation which is a bit strange. So he's achieved his goal, which was to play for Real Madrid and become number one goal scorer for Real Madrid. But that club is a mess. That team is a mess. Tempers are fraught. He hasn't exactly shown in terms of the example he sets to others. There have been loads of controversies and a bit distasteful. So it might be that it changes. It might be that it changes. And it might be that he changes, because you know what? Where do you go after Real Madrid? That's a problem. Where do you go? You go to Bayern? Actually, why not? You know, they're on the up, young team as well. He won't go to Arsenal because they haven't got the money to pay for him. Where else can he go? Manchester City, they'll probably be in League Two by the time he can move. I sincerely hope so. But where do you go? That's the problem. And everything is a springboard to Real Madrid for one reason or another. And if you leave Real Madrid for another club, in a way, he's not going to go back to PSG because they don't want him, because they're doing very well, thank you. And also, he's very expensive. Who can afford him?
Yeah.
And you think, is he a bit stuck? Which is crazy. How can you be stuck at Real Madrid? Well, you can be when you don't win anything, which is what's happening to them, what's happening to him.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very strange situation to be in. Quite unique, in fact. How many players have left Real Madrid to go on to bigger things? Actually, that's a quiz question almost. Can you think of any? I mean, can you think of anyone who left Real Madrid as a big player? Because as a part-time player, yes, plenty of them have done that.
Yeah.
But if you think of the real, you know, Benzema and Cristiano, they went to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Raul Gonzalez didn't go to, wherever he might have gone. David Beckham moved on, but it's Beckham. It was a circus anyway. So, no, I mean, I can't think of any player who achieved, who was part of that big, of a big Real team, who went on to become an even greater player somewhere else.
Yeah.
Is there an example that is screaming at us and that I cannot see and that obviously you
can't
see
either? I
really
don't think so. I think it's a destination for careers, and as you say that.
It's a terminus.
Yeah, it makes it a fascinating point in his career. Unfortunately, it's the destination for this bit of the conversation because we're running a little bit short on your time.
Okay, that's fine.
There were several questions talking about having sui generis careers. There were a few things I wanted to talk to you about, but I'm conscious you've got work to get to. But you know, you've been a French football writer in England, based in England for a long time, but a lot of that time where, you know, this relationship between the Premier League and the rise of kind of France as a real footballing
it's a thread
power nationally, that's a thread through your career. And now you're doing work with Yossimar at a point where the success of football is kind of beyond doubt, but at the same time there's a lot beneath the facade. I mean, how has all of that shaped your perspective and your relationship with football? You also have all these kind of other influences and music and other things that you're into. Like, what is it? Yeah, what's your relationship with football, I suppose, as a journalist and as a writer?
Well, especially the type of journalism I do, which is basically taking a rock and looking at what's crawling from underneath. And you know, looking at private equity, multi-club ownership, state ownership, sports washing, corruption, you name it, Gianni Infantino, dare I say anything else. So I do think the sport is moribund in many ways. In moral terms, I think it's sunk to depths that I think were absolutely impossible to imagine. And it's one of the most corrupt environments there is, and in sport and elsewhere. It's rotten to the core. I have absolutely no doubt about that. It's absolutely rotten to the core. On the other hand, my argument is that it's far too beautiful a game to be left to the bastards. So I see my role as trying to kick as many bastards as I can where it hurts. But on the other hand, it still generates... I don't have a problem with contemporary players, for example, unlike other people. I don't. The ones that I've spoken to, I actually quite like. I think they're there for the right reasons. I don't think that they're necessarily mercenary or shallow or all these things. I don't think so. And even for PSG, and which is a club that I've written absolute horrors about and will carry on doing so, I have a lot of time for that team, for the players. Mm-hmm. I do think I've given his name already, I don't know how many times, but Kvaratskhelia for me is the reason why I love football. I just love watching this player. I love the fire in him as well as the talent and everything else. I like the modesty, the humility, and at the same time, the almost superhuman feats that he's able to do with the ball at his feet. And you're reminded of that quite often. You know, when you saw that game between Arsenal and West Ham yesterday, I didn't think about the money or the people who own those clubs. And heaven knows that there's plenty to say about both the Kroenke and David Sullivan. Mm-hmm. We won't go there. Not now. Or about their sponsors, the fact that all of them are, they're sponsored by an authoritarian regime in the case of Arsenal, we've been flying Emirates for far too long and have been helping Paul Kagame and Rwanda and so forth. And that's distasteful and disgusting and needs to be said. And West Ham are not doing much better in this particular context. On the other hand, the real football is what happens on the pitch and what happens between the pitch and the stands and the players and the fans. That's what matters. So I think you've got to It's not cognitive dissonance, because cognitive dissonance, the problem is that most people are not even aware of it. Mm-hmm. I think if you are, I've got awareness, if you are awake, if you're woke in the proper sense of the word, if you're aware of the disconnect and you accept it and refuse it at the same time, then you're able to still enjoy it and rejoice for Rochdale, what they did, and rejoice for even for, I don't know if Bournemouth, and God knows that the ownership of Bournemouth is, he's not the great owner, and also their relation with illegal sports betting operators is disgraceful. But Bournemouth, the team, is superb, and I wish them luck, mm-hmm. and I hope they qualify for the Champions League. So we're living in this age of constant dissonance, but we have to be aware of it. I think the awareness is the most important thing there is. And we shouldn't decide that football has become is a horrible thing. This is not true. Football is absolutely magnificent, and it remains so. And there are tons of stories. If you look at what Racing Club de Lens have been doing in France, what you look at what Bodo Glimt did in the Champions League, this is what matters. This is why we're still fascinated by it. This is why, even when the World Cup comes, and I'm not going, but I'm sure there will be one or two stories that will, you know, capture our hearts and our souls and imaginations, despite everything else. And heaven knows that this is the ugliest World Cup coming after Qatar. This is the ugliest World Cup that there has ever been, and will be the ugliest until we go to Saudi Arabia. It's a horrible tournament, and everybody knows so, and everybody says so. But the same way that when Saudi Arabia beat Argentina in Qatar, I was really happy for them. Mm-hmm. And I was not happy because for Mohammed bin Salman, but I was thinking, first of all, well done, guys, who were on the pitch. That fantastic what you did. And I was really happy for the Saudi people, not the regime, the people, the fans. Saudi fans, for them, it was the greatest day of their lives. So let's not steal that joy, and let's not kill that joy, because the people who are trying to exploit, who are exploiting football, are becoming better and better at it and do everything in their power to ruin it, because what they want is money and power. So we have to carry on loving it to better protect it. Otherwise, we've lost.
Okay. Well said. Right, three questions that I ask every guest I let you go. The first one is, do you have an origin story or something that sparked your own interest in sport?
First of all, I used to practice a lot of sport. That was a while ago, but, you know, athletics, tennis, football, rugby, basketball, you name it. But I would say, probably, if you look really the origin story, for me, it's George Best.
Okay.
It was Best. But I'm not a Manchester United fan. And to be honest, I saw very little of George Best. But believe it or not, it was between him and Pelé in, you know, at school. And we fantasized. And my fantasy was George Best, I suppose.
Yeah,
when I was a wee boy, and few things I saw from him and so forth, and you know, the very few times we saw anything on television, but mostly it was photographs, you know, Le Miroir du Football or France Football, but heavens above. And then comes Johan Cruyff, you know. So that's my school, basically. That's where I come from, George Best and Johan Cruyff. There's worse.
And I mean, that comes back to something that you kind of explore early on in the book, or that's kind of a thematic foundation of the book, is, you know, the way that people discovered these icons.
Yeah.
Only a few decades ago was you saw a handful of clips, maybe you saw photographs, you heard reports and read reports.
Yeah.
But actually lots of it lived in the imagination rather than...
Which is fine.
Hundreds of thousands of hours of video.
And I think our perception was just as right in many ways, because you had to build it. You had to use your imagination. And I have to say, people who were telling the stories were very good at telling them as well, because they were not telling them the way we have to tell them today. Mm-hmm. You had actually to keep to broad strokes. You had to see things from a bit further back on one, you know. And I mean, the difference as well was I mean, my generation would be the first who actually did see some football on television, because, you know, we saw the Champions League, well, the European Cup, we saw that. We saw the FA Cup final, was always shown on French television. We saw the Euro, we saw the World Cup and so forth. We saw a little bit of the French League, a little bit. We saw the Coupe de France. So we saw a few things, but nothing like, you know, we didn't have anything on tap. So therefore, players seem to be much greater and bigger and more talented than probably they would have seemed if we had seen them every week. Because, you know, it was all about the legend, which is just a rather lovely thing, actually. We want legend.
Speaking of which, what's your favorite piece of sports storytelling?
I would say, but that will surprise you. It would not be football. It would be cricket for me. It would be cricket. It's the book that made me fall in love with cricket, which was The Art of Captaincy by Mike Brearley.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, I know. A bit unusual, but that if I had to save one book from my collection, that would be the one. Strange, isn't it? I mean, I'm sure I've read a few other things, which might be better written, better this, better that. But it's what matters is the trace it leaves in you, and that's the book that made me realize, oh, there's this whole universe called cricket. I love it, and I didn't know even the rules when I read the book. I didn't even know what the rules of cricket or the laws of cricket were. But I was totally taken in.
Yeah. Because people think of that as not quite a manual, but like it's a psychological study of you know, a team. And what do you think it was about that? Because it's not about the sport. It's not, you know, it's not a reflection. Oh, sorry, it is about the sport, but it's not about games that have happened or, you know, it's something different.
I'm a chess player and... it's really talks about cricket as if it were chess on grass, and I love that idea. I love the idea that you can be an author as a sports person, and a cricket captain can be an author on the pitch. So I like that, and I like also the exoticism of it. For a Frenchman, it's a very exotic thing in which the main countries are India, Pakistan, you know, West Indies. Come on, man. So it is also the way, I suppose, I totally feel the way that really talks about sports and the challenges of sports and the relationship between sports people and between the captain and the rest of the team is something which really grabbed me completely. Because I think it's a book that should be given to every sportsman, or sports person, I should say, every coach should be given a copy of this and say, read this, come back to me, and think about it in terms of your own sport. And it's possible to have as profound an understanding, but it's a human understanding. That's the thing which matters. It's not about stats and so, it's the human understanding. And, you know, the famous thing that Botham Singh of Brearley has got a degree in people. And so that's what really, really absolutely, it bowled me over, that book. I don't know how many copies I've gone through because I gave them away. I think I've kept my signed copy. I think that's about it.
Wise choice. Okay. Finally, what's a sports story you'd like to tell or see someone else tell? Now, always good to ask someone this when they've just finished a book.
Yeah, there's plenty. I'm not at liberty to tell you because I'm working on something right now. Okay. And also, many of the book I'd like to write myself is, I've thought about that for a long time. It's the story I wasn't able to tell you. And there are plenty of those. And it obviously is for legal reasons. Most of the time that I haven't been able to tell those particular stories, but they're true. And I think the world would be a better place if they were told, but I don't know. I hope I can write a book about how Arsenal did the double in 25-26. Okay. That would be a non-contentious choice.
non-contentious from your perspective, but maybe
from mine,
judging by the reactions,
not.
some of this season.
Absolutely, and they all go if you don't win anything. Yeah. But whatever.
Well, let's hope you get to write that book, Philippe. Thank you. It's been a real joy. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.